From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The sword itself calls a man to violence, wrote the ancient Greek sage Homer. If that's true, watch out for America's police. They are armed, militarized, like never before. The images out of Ferguson, Missouri have shown those heavy arms shaping attitudes in a direction that may be dangerous for democracy. It's a national issue lit up by a week of protest and mayhem. This hour on Point, the latest from Ferguson, plus taking on the militarization of America's police. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Have you seen militarized police in your town? The big MRAPs and Bearcats on the road alongside your SUV? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Later this hour, we will hear from a congressman pushing legislation to stop the slide to police militarization. On Saturday in Ferguson, Captain Ron Johnson of the Missouri Highway Patrol, commander for security over protesters in Ferguson, talked about plans for peacefully enforcing, that was Saturday night's curfew, despite Friday's pretty rugged events. It hasn't gone so well since. Here's Captain Johnson.
Tonight, we will enforce that curfew. We won't enforce it with trucks. We won't enforce it with tear gas. We'll communicate. We'll talk about, you know what, it's time to go home. It's time to go home. You have not seen a hand-in-hand approach. Last night, some things were different that precipitated that, and you saw that. You saw that. But I can tell you, because someone's standing in the street, there's not going to be an armored truck come out. You saw people sitting in the street, and they got a chance to get up. And that's the way it's going to continue.
Well, some heavy stuff was back. The National Guard is now in Ferguson and sitting in the street, not allowed as of yesterday. We're going to look at the militarization of America's police, but I want to go first to Ferguson, Missouri, and the latest there. St. Louis Alderman, who's been at the center of the Ferguson turmoil, Antonio French, joins us. He represents St. Louis' 21st Ward. He's been in the thick of the protests, documenting and speaking out from the beginning, advocating for justice there. He was arrested while at the protests Wednesday night for unlawful assembly. Was released the next morning. Antonio French joins us from St. Louis. Alderman French, thank you very much for being here.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
How would you describe the state of this story in Ferguson now? Where are we at, Alderman French?
Well, we're still in it. We're still in the crisis. And you know, a lot of us are really looking forward to the healing part, but we can't even get there as long as we still have tear gas in our streets and you know, people not being allowed to walk freely out of fear of either police or guys out there looking to start trouble.
Let's speak first to the protesters. They have stayed very evident in the streets. People have come from all over the country, all over the world for that matter. At this point, how would you translate the message from the streets of Ferguson? What's the demand?
Well, listen, this thing has really morphed over the last 11, 12 days since I've been on the ground. And what started with the case of one man who was shot by a police officer and killed on his way to his apartment complex has really turned into something much bigger. And the central thing is still about getting justice in that shooting. Waiting for the evidence to come in, waiting for the slow wheels of justice to move forward so we can get a resolution to this for the family and the people who believe that that young man was killed without cause. So that's the first thing. But since then, and really this was a result of the way the local police department handled those initial protests, which was an overreaction, a gross militarization of what was just a simple peaceful protest. And they've escalated it to the point now that it has become violent. And so, thank goodness, the local police were taken out of command. The governor stepped in and put in the very capable Captain Johnson from the Missouri Highway Patrol. He's really changed the tone and the face of the policing of this effort. However, in that time, it was still allowed to fester a group that are really determined to fight back. You know, whenever police come to either shut down or control the crowds, there's a group that are prepared to fight back. And some of them have weapons. And And what has happened is it's taken on two dynamics, and we saw that last night.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have in the daytime peaceful protests. In fact, I don't think we've had any problems over this entire period in the daytime. But as night falls, there's almost two groups. So in the front, all of these take place on West Flushing Avenue. So in the front near Ferguson Avenue, up the street, it is a peaceful section. But as confrontation happens, the group falls back to the back of the street and then shoots off into off streets, into neighborhoods. And then that's where the police pursue them. Gunshots are heard, and police usually respond with tear gas, rubber bullets. The unfortunate thing is that that's a residential area, and so that tear gas just spreads, and children and family live in those apartments, and they're really caught in the middle. And so it's just a bad situation, and a lot of us are out there just trying to keep the peace and just, get back to normal, really, just get back to normal.
Alderman, you, Ron Johnson, Captain Johnson, described these, and we've heard this in the news throughout the day today, as criminals who have intermixed with the peaceful protesters. You described them as a group that would fight back. There's an interesting difference between those two depictions. What's going on here?
Well, it might depend on your perspective, but, I do agree with the captain is that we now have some folks who have come in from other areas who are armed and are not necessarily there for the same reason the daytime protesters are. And so he refers to them as criminals. I've just called them the guys who are fighting, more like a rebel component of it. But they are definitely more violent, and that on that we both agree.
Antonio French, stand by for just a second. Here was the president yesterday talking about the situation in Ferguson and pointing to concerns over the militarization of police.
There is a big difference between our military and our local law enforcement, and we don't want those lines blurred. That would be contrary to our traditions.
Antonio French, alderman from St. Louis, in the center of this in Ferguson, did you see the lines blurred in Ferguson between police and military?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Especially those first few days, we were really shocked to see the equipment that local police were bringing out. You're talking about large tank-like assault vehicles, snipers on the roof trained at unarmed protesters, assault rifles. Yeah, this was something that you would think you would see in another country. And then the guys lined up in camouflage gear with gas masks on. Ferguson is a small suburb. You don't think you're going to see this kind of stuff there.
How did citizens of Ferguson interpret that show of force? What did they take it to mean? How did they see the message in that?
Well, the difficult situation we are in today is really because of that tone that was initially set by the local police when they were in charge of the situation. And so when I say heavy-handed, I mean heavy-handed. So people were literally getting tear gas in their own backyards. They were standing on their property and being tear gassed. And that really set the tone for the anger that we're having to deal with today, that Captain Johnson is having to deal with today. And it's justifiable. And what we're out there trying to do, and believe me, I'm one that's been out there and has been tear gassed and was arrested mm-hmm. and put in jail. But even now, I think the best thing for all of us is to take a breath and to calm down before this escalates and more people get hurt. There's always a place for protest and even civil disobedience. But the kind of violence that we've seen is literally war on our streets, and that's not what that doesn't help anybody.
We've seen violent actors in the night, Captain Johnson talking about them there. But I want to go back to the message in that first show of force and how people interpreted it. Was it a sit down and shut up message? What was it? These were American citizens facing those big pieces of equipment.
Yeah, and I think I think that situation and what started this all are really related. You have in Ferguson a majority African-American population, two-thirds African-American, an almost all-white government, an almost all-white police department. And what you've seen is that there isn't much communication or understanding between those groups right now. And as a result, it's been a heavy-handed overreaction that is more about controlling these folks than serving or protecting. And so when the Ferguson Police Department saw these large crowds, their approach was to try to control them. And there was so much anger, and especially with these young guys, a lot of them who do carry weapons, that you're not going to be able to beat these folks into submission. That's not going to happen. And furthermore, when we get through this crisis, we all have to live together. You know, this is still a community, and every community still does need police. And so you don't want to create some wounds during this period that will make it even harder for us to heal afterwards.
Alderman Antonio French of St. Louis, Missouri. Seen a lot of him in Ferguson in the last week and more. Alderman French, Antonio French, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Be safe. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Sound there, a big truck, Bearcat armored truck, headed into Ferguson last night, Monday night. More trouble there. And it came after a day in which we had police trying to disperse protesters, peaceful protesters, in the streets of Ferguson. It has been pretty wild in Ferguson this week, and it's led a lot of Americans to look there and to their own police departments at the degree of militarization that has occurred in recent years. We're talking this hour about the uproar in Ferguson, Missouri, the militarization of America's police forces, and now the National Guard brought in there. Here on Friday, speaking with News 1, one protester, James Cage, in Ferguson, expressed frustration about the show of militarization there.
The police pointing rifles and shotguns and everything at you and stuff. It don't make no sense. This is supposed to be the United States. People in other countries. The terrorists now. On the news, the terrorists in the terrorist country. They think they got us on their side now because they seen all those tanks. They wonder what we did to make them pull out military equipment on the so-called American population.
And here on Sunday, talking with a public radio member station, KCUR, one resident who only gave his name is Bubba, saying the police action, including tear gas and more, was actually encouraging more unrest.
You know what happens when you back a dog in the corner. He's going to act out and he's going to bite you aggressively. You can't treat people like animals. Treat people how you want to be treated. That's the golden rule, I thought. So if they don't want to honor the golden rule, well, then the result is going to be the actions that you see.
Policing is not always easy, and it has certainly not been easy this last week in Ferguson, Missouri. But we've had an eyeful of the militarization of American police forces, and it goes well beyond Ferguson. We want to look at the origins of that in this hour and what it might take to put that kind of ugly genie back in the bottle. With us from New York is Radley Balco. He writes The Watch for the Washington Post, blogs on criminal justice, war on drugs, civil liberties. Radley Balco is author of The Rise of the Warrior Cop, the Militarization of America's Police Forces. Radley Balco, thank you very much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
And with us from Sterling, Virginia, is Kara Dansky, senior counsel at the American Civil Liberties Union Center for Justice, author of War Comes Home, The Excessive Militarization of American Policing. Kara Dansky, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Radley Balco, take us back to the beginning. Where did this come from?
Well, I think you start to see a lot of these tactics and a lot of the war rhetoric. You can go back to the Nixon administration in 1968, where crime was soaring out of control at the time, and Nixon proposed a number of policies really aimed at sort of declaring a war on crime and a war on drugs. And that's really, I think, where you start to see this kind of rhetoric, you know, militaristic kind of martial rhetoric from elected officials. I think the modern kind of move toward militarization starts in the early 1980s. during the Reagan administration, particularly in 1986 after the death of the basketball star Len Bias, you saw both parties decide to respond to the drug war with policies aimed at really making the drug war metaphor very literal, bringing in the National Guard to fight the drug war, instructing the Pentagon sort of informally to start giving military equipment away to police departments across the country. That later becomes formalized in the 1990s in the 1033 program. But then you also see things like training between drug interdiction police agencies and groups like the Navy SEALs and the Army Rangers. You create these joint task forces between the military and domestic policing. One policy that actually didn't get enacted that would have been particularly terrifying is both Reagan and leaders from both political parties at the time wanted the military, the active military, to come in and start fighting the drug war. They wanted Marines doing drug raids and marching up and down streets. Unfortunately, that didn't happen, and I think a big reason is the Pentagon itself put up a huge fight, which I think is a healthy thing. But, you know, if your fear of having soldiers, you know, do day-to-day policing, whether it's responding to protesting or conducting drug raids, if your fear is that that's not an appropriate role for a soldier, and it isn't. I mean, a soldier's job is to basically annihilate a foreign enemy. A police officer's job is to keep the peace. But if that's your fear, you know, I'm not sure there's much difference between a soldier actually doing these things and a domestic police officer who has been armed, dressed up like, outfitted with, trained and trained like a soldier, and then told, you know, every day that he's fighting a war, whether it's a war on crime or terror or drugs. So that's really where we see kind of the rise of the SWAT team and the rise of militarization, the camouflage, the military gear, and also a willingness among police agencies to use increasingly more force for increasingly petty offenses. And this is where we see SWAT teams go from used primarily in emergency situation where lives are at stake, you know, active shooters and bank robberies and hostage takings, to today where they're primarily used to serve drug warrants on people who are still merely suspected of nonviolent consensual drug crimes. So I think this is all part of a kind of a broader narrative of police moving toward a more militaristic stance with the public and a willingness to use more force.
Kara Dansky, we know that over time, through history, American policing has not always been patty cake by any means. There's a kind of ebb and flow to the ferocity. But if you look back to the civil rights era, I mean, even in Alabama, look at where, you know, confronting people on the bridge and more. Yes, there are fire hoses and billy clubs and even bull whips, but you don't have all this military gear. In recent years, Kara, what's been pushing this, what looks like a gusher of military gear, armaments and big equipment into local police forces?
Well, I think that's right. And I think one of the key differences is really these federal programs that are fueling the excessive, unnecessary, and quite frankly, dangerous militarization of policing. But I want to get back to something that Alderman French said, which is that the situation in Ferguson started when yet another unarmed black man was killed by the police, and people were expressing understandable outrage about that. And, you know, the police came in with a show of force that was utterly unnecessary and a complete overreaction to the situation that was presenting itself. And what we saw in Ferguson is reflective of what we have seen across the country with the increasing militarization of the police, which is that when the police go in with unnecessarily aggressive and militarized tactics, that tends to undermine public safety and it tends to escalate the risk of violence. And one of the messages that we tried to send when we published our report on this subject in June is that, you know, and as you say, the police have been excessively militarized in certain communities for a very long time. It definitely goes back to the civil rights era, and as Radley said, it goes back to the 80s and 90s when the federal government started really fueling this trend and fueling local police with first money and then actual weaponry from the Pentagon's arsenal, which the police have been using disproportionately and unfairly in black communities and Latino communities.
So this program, how does it work? Is there a public record? Can we track what the Defense Department is pushing where? Is it clear, or do we not learn until there's some kind of a problem and suddenly we're surrounded by a homegrown army?
The lack of data on the militarization of policing in all of its forms is a huge part of the problem. When we went out to do our study, we submitted public record requests to hundreds of police departments, and many of them didn't respond. Many of them did respond, but they would give us incomplete records or sometimes records that were missing information, and we tried to connect the dots, and we did what we think is a solid statistical analysis of just over 800 SWAT raids, the overwhelming majority of which were conducted in people's homes, often to search for very small amounts of drugs, disproportionately impacting Black people and Latino people. And we were not able to connect many of the dots in terms of the use of equipment that came from the Pentagon. It's very difficult to access data on the collection and use of this equipment. And it's also very difficult to track the money that's coming from the Departments of Justice and Homeland Security, which local police then use to buy weapons directly from weapons manufacturers above and beyond what they can get free from the Pentagon.
I mean, we're seeing reports here in Watertown, Connecticut, a $730,000 mine-resistant, ambush-protected MRAP vehicle in Watertown, Connecticut, sold there to them for $2,800. I'm not sure for what. In Michigan, Indiana, the same program, 1033, the federal program, used to acquire MRAP armored troop carriers, night vision rifle scopes, camouflage fatigues, Humvees, and dozens of M16 automatic rifles. That from the South Bend Tribune, Newsweek is telling us. Police in Bloomington, Georgia, acquiring four grenade launchers through the program. The Atlanta Journal-Constitution reporting. That's a lot of equipment. Radley Balco, you know, we're quoting Homer here from ancient days, saying the blade itself calls a man to violence. Is the very presence of this equipment changing attitudes and tactics?
I think it is. I mean, I think when you surround yourself with that, you start to assume the mentality and the mindset of a soldier, which is not, you know, the mentality of a peace officer. The Indianapolis Star expose on the transfer of weapons to police departments in Indiana included a quote from a sheriff in Pulaski County, Indiana, which is a fairly rural community, talking about how America today has descended into a war zone. It hasn't. I mean, it hasn't at all. There was a SWAT commander in Sterling Heights, Michigan, when my book came out, who wrote a response to my book on the website Police One, who, you know, referred to his beat as his sector. He referred to his job as a police officer as his tour of duty. And he said police officers today face greater threats than an active duty soldiers in Iraq and Afghanistan, which is patently false. The reality is crime has been declining, violent crime has been declining since 1994. Though we hear a lot about these mass shootings, James Allen Fox, criminologist in Massachusetts, I believe, has actually studied this and has not found that. He's found that they tend to cluster, but we're not even seeing an increase in these mass shootings. So the idea that America is, you know, succumbing to crime, that's becoming a war zone or a danger zone, there's just no data to back that up. And so, you know, when you have police officers who think that, in spite of the fact that there's no data to back that up, I think you enter very sort of precarious territory. Policing is a very sort of decision-oriented job. Norm Stamper, the former police chief in Seattle, described the differences. You know, soldiers follow orders. Police officers make decisions, and those decisions should be about de-escalation and about conflict resolution. And police officers should see their job as, if they have to use force, to use the minimum amount of force possible. And what we're seeing in Ferguson is, you know, if you watch some of the cable news, you see people from the military saying this is completely unacceptable. I mean, I've seen former military people say you never point your gun at someone unless you're prepared to kill them. And in Ferguson, we've seen lots of instances of people with their arms in the air having, you know, laser sights being pointed at them. I think we may have even ventured into territory where some police departments have become more militarized than the U.S. military.
Almost with this sense of careless bravado, as if these were not fellow citizens. We know it's been a tough scene there sometimes, but these are American citizens. Radley Balco, author of The Rise of the Warrior Cop. Kara Dansky, War Comes Home. Please stand by. Our listeners coming in heavy here. Kevin in Orlando, Florida. Kevin, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. About a year and a half ago, the police raided a barbershop in the Black part of town. It's a Black barbershop, looking for barbers that were cutting hair without a license. They lined them all up. SWAT team shows up, machine guns, whole nine yards. Later, the police felt that, well, maybe that was overreaction. And just imagine that message it sends across the world and into the Black community. And then the second thing is, I don't go to the Christmas parade here in Winter Park anymore because the police show up with an armored vehicle. And my son asked me, why is the Army here? I don't do that anymore. We don't go. And my real bottom line with this Ferguson issue is if that police officer had a camera on his body and a dash camera, we'd have a totally different discussion. And that chief of police, I really think, is negligent by not buying what he needs. Instead of buying MRAPs, M4s, sniper rifles, he should be buying body cameras and dash cameras.
We may be headed there, a lot of them already, but there may be many more. It does make sense that in a democracy they ought to outnumber this heavy weaponry and military vehicles. I mean, Karadansky, you hear that, you know, SWAT teams brought in to examine barbershop licenses and a man who doesn't want to go to the Christmas parade because of this militarization. There seems to me something absolutely antithetical to democracy in this heavy militarized police presence.
Well, it's absolutely ridiculous to send in a SWAT team into a barbershop and, you know, to search for licenses. But, you know, this is really what we're dealing with. And as we've been discussing, a lot of the money and the weaponry that's come from the federal government came specifically to fuel the war on drugs, which the federal government in the 1980s and 1990s was very interested in fueling. And they sent money and weapons to local police to wage that war, again, unfairly and disproportionately in communities of color. And it's gone way beyond that. So we see the police adopting a very militaristic stance, thinking of the neighborhoods that they're supposed to be serving as combat zones, thinking of the people they're supposed to be serving as enemies, and really adopting a very militaristic mindset to do things like go into barbershops to ask for licenses.
Radley Balco, this, on the other hand, this has not been a barbershop quartet singing for this last week. There have been some pretty tough scenes. Is some of this justified? I mean, the National Guard's there now, but so far they're just protecting police headquarters. But in a way, you don't have to have them out anymore when the police have so much heavy equipment. What about moments when it's justified? And what about the Ferguson example?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think once you have shootings and looting and rioting, you know, the police do have to have a heavy response. But I think Kara and I think Councilman French sort of nailed the important point here, which is that you don't want it to get to that point. And once it gets to that point, you've failed as a police agency. I wanted to respond real quick to the barbershop thing. And that was in Orlando, Florida.
Yes.
Unless the caller was talking about a separate incident.
No, it was Orlando, yes.
And in that case, those police were actually looking for drugs, and they did not have enough evidence to get a search warrant that they were actually turned down. So they turned this into a regulatory inspection, which they used the SWAT team to perform as a way of getting around the Fourth Amendment, so they didn't need a warrant. They found barely any drugs. I think they arrested a few dozen people for barbering without a license. But, I mean, this is what we're seeing more and more is even mission creep, even beyond and above and beyond the drug war with these SWAT teams. So they're being used for white-collar crimes, for petty crimes, for regulatory inspections. In fact, in St. Louis County, I reported on this last year, St. Louis County, which, you know, one of the sources of all this militarization, these images that we're seeing, last year they served a warrant for an administrative warrant for white-collar crime. When a local news station asked them why that kind of force was necessary, the department responded that in St. Louis County, they serve every search warrant with a SWAT team, regardless of the crime. So, you know, this was a level of force that was once reserved for these emergency kinds of situations where lives are at stake. And now in St. Louis County, and I'm sure in other jurisdictions, it's become the default use of force anytime police need to serve a search warrant.
We want to talk about how this can be turned around. Karadansky, very briefly, we'll look at this in the next segment, but do you see a way? Can we scratch back this equipment? Can we turn around this attitude?
Well, it's certainly time to rein in the 1033 program and to limit the kinds of equipment that the police are able to get for free from the Pentagon. You know, and it's important to point out that there's another provision, a related provision, that allows emergency responders to have access to the equipment that they need. So we need to take a really careful look at this.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the uproar in Ferguson, Missouri, and the militarization of America's police forces. We saw it big time on the streets of Ferguson, and now a lot of people looking around at the equipment and maybe attitudes in their own local police departments and just where they've migrated over the years. Here was protest last week, just people in the streets exercising First Amendment rights after a very unexplained shooting.
Don't shoot!
Hands up!
Don't shoot!
Hands up!
Don't shoot!
Hands up!
But all over the country, there is equipment and preparation that can take these things in a pretty serious direction. Here's the New Jersey Somerset County Police. They've received grants from the Pentagon 1033 program. Here's their SWAT team practicing shooting down targets with their M16 machine guns. Of course, when you're in the thick of something like Ferguson, it's tough. Here's the governor of Missouri. Talking about attempting to respond to a question from the crowd, why is the focus on security and not getting justice?
If we want justice, we cannot be distracted. We must be focused on making sure that people are allowed their First Amendment rights, but we do so in a peaceful fashion. We cannot have looting and crimes at night. We can't have people fearful.
We can't have people fearful. Governor Jay Nixon says they're true. We can't have police officers killing people, says the crowd. Also true. Not willy-nilly, that's for sure. With us this hour, Radley Balco, author of The Rise of the Warrior Cop, The Militarization of America's Police Forces, is with us from New York. Kara Dansky joins us from Sterling, Virginia, senior counsel at the American Civil Liberties Union's Center for Justice and author of War Comes Home, a big report they put out on the militarization of local, even small-town police forces. And with us right now from Lithonia, Georgia, is Congressman Hank Johnson, Democratic representative from Georgia's 4th Congressional District, elected in 2006, serves on the Committee on Armed Services and Committee on the Judiciary. He's been working on a bill introduced in September called Stop Militarizing Law Enforcement Act. Representative Johnson, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
We've heard John Conyers, ranking member of the Judiciary Committee, calling for hearings on what we've seen in the St. Louis suburbs. What would your bill do, Congressman?
Well, my bill would terminate the ability of a local law enforcement agency to send a one-page request to the Department of Defense for a piece of military equipment, surplus military equipment, and take possession of it, and perhaps not be well-trained in when and how and where to use it. And so this is free equipment that is coming straight from the battlefield to the streets of the nation, and it bypasses the civilian governing authority that normally would have to vote to make a purchase of this type of equipment.
Mm-hmm.
And so the 1033 program is a good program with respect to other non-military hardware surplus equipment that should be available to state and local governments. But this heavy, these tactical vehicles, armored drones, flashbang and stun grenades, even silencers, weapons, automatic weapons, these kinds of tools of war have no place generally on the streets of America.
Congressman Johnson, after what we've seen in Ferguson, do you think there may be bipartisan support for this on Capitol Hill? I mean, you've got liberals upset, you've got conservative libertarians upset, you've got all kinds of citizens, I mean, some who are comforted by this, and that's a factor out there, but you've got all kinds of citizens saying, not in our country, please. Do you see a bipartisan support for this?
Well, unfortunately, in the midst of political gridlock and obstruction of things that our Congress needs to be about, I cannot say with great confidence that we will have a bipartisan bill and that it will get the hearing that it needs in the Congress before the end of this year. I cannot say that. But we're going to work hard because I know that conditions are changing. People across the nation are seeing what's happening in Ferguson, Missouri. And more people are realizing that this is not a phenomenon that is limited to urban, inner-city neighborhoods where black folks reside. It can happen in any location. And indeed, the Rambo, Robo style of policing has affected other areas, rural areas involving Caucasians. And so I think people are starting to wake up and realize that, no, this is not something that just is a city problem, but it is a problem that afflicts communities across the country, and it's growing.
Congressman Hank Johnson of Georgia's 4th Congressional District, thank you very much for joining us, Congressman. Good luck to you.
Thank you, Tom.
Got to watch out for that attitude of impunity that can come behind the big guns and gear. Betty in Burnside, Kentucky. Betty, thank you for calling. What do you see?
Thank you. On August 15th, 4 days ago, All Things Considered, your national security reporter said that Homeland Security contracts with the police and sheriff departments all over this country say, use the armaments or lose them. And so what I see this is, mostly the war against the poor and people of color has been economic up until now, but they are preparing for the inevitable rebellion of poor and people of color because that's all that automatic weapons are about, is mass anti-personnel and all the other armaments.
You've got a kind of apocalyptic view of it, but we'll pick it up, and I appreciate your call, Betty. Radley Balco, there's a couple layers here. You hear what Betty has to say. Here's another. Paula writes to us on Facebook, says, if we're going to have a society that's divided by extreme wealth and large segments of poor, we better have a militarized police. The wealthy will need protection as time goes on. What do you think of that view, Radley?
It is a bit apocalyptic, and I do also think that, you know, this is a problem that is actually spreading beyond the traditional communities that Kara points out have been disproportionately affected. There's a sad kind of realpolitik to this, which is that as this gets worse, I think the odds of it getting better improve, which is to say that as these tactics start to be used for white-collar crimes, for petty offenses, they're more likely to affect people who are going to have, you know, a platform and the political clout to do something about it. It's no coincidence that the first state, and as of now, one of only two states, to pass a law reforming SWAT teams in any way, and it was actually just a transparency bill. It required every police department with a SWAT team to report on how it uses it and how often and so forth. The first state to do that was Maryland, and that came only after a botched drug raid on a mayor in Maryland, in which the police killed his dogs and held he and his mother-in-law at gunpoint for hours. They were both completely innocent. But it's telling that, you know, it took a member of the political class being affected by this trend for the first state to actually enact any sort of reform legislation whatsoever.
Sam in New York, Amherst, New York. Thanks for calling, Sam. You're on the air.
Yes, hi. I'd like to say I appreciate the callers who recognize that it's an issue of color, as in race, against people of color, African-American, Hispanic. And I also appreciate the caller who agrees that it's a problem across all of America and not just ethnic minorities. I personally feel that it is a problem affecting minorities. That type of force, in my opinion, being African-American and Asian, is that it's the way the people feel about the black people or minority people. Blacks and Hispanics are the people who are going to jail. In your schools, it's the young kids in predominantly urban settings who are having problems with systems. So you go from the elementary schools, you know, on your way to a teenager and then in your adult life somewhere, and you have some affiliation with, like, the judicial system of sorts. But I do believe that kind of force is reflective of America. Not that all Americans feel that way, certainly, but just as a general sense, this is the truth about America. I do believe that.
Sam, I appreciate your call, and you may be right. It's not one we want to accept. We want to work on it. We want to make it better. John, thank you. John in Cleveland, Ohio. John, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thank you. I've got a couple points here, and I'm probably going to tick off some of your listeners. I'm hearing a lot of anti-police rhetoric.
What is anti-police about saying, let's not militarize? Is that anti-police? I mean, we're all for good policing,
well,
but...
You got to look at what people are doing out there, too. I'm involved in law enforcement. I see the guns. I see the violence. When you get into a situation where, you know, officers deal with unknown circumstances every day, and nowadays with the proliferation of all sorts of weapons, not just guns, knives, the drugs and everything else, you don't know what a guy is going to do on a traffic stop. You don't know that the person you're approaching, if they are a felon, if they have just committed a felony. And the media wants to side and bash the cops right away. And when the people follow the media and the media is saying how bad the cops are, the people get upset. They attack the police. What do you want the police to do?
John, let me just say I deeply respect important and good policing. But as a citizen in a democracy, I'm concerned about this militarization. Look, we talk plenty here about the arming up of the whole country, and I realize that puts police in a tough position. But do you really, in your heart of hearts, John, want to see police departments that look like militaries? Is that good for this country?
No, but when I see rural counties in Ohio dealing with drug gangs out of Detroit because it is an open market and they're coming down here and they're bringing their violence down, and you've got small agencies that don't routinely deal with it, and you traffic stop a car and there's an AK-47, an SKS rifle, and the officer yep. simply has a handgun, you need something to meet that threat when it's presented. We have had officers go on traffic stops where a guy gets out with a gun immediately and starts firing on officers. The militarization, as you keep using that word.
Well, I'm just describing what I'm seeing.
Simply given some tactical training to preserve their lives. It's not to run out there and gun citizens down or anything else. Officers work with a lot of restraint. No officer I know decides to go to work today and say, I'm going to go out and shoot somebody. None of us want to do that.
Hey, and we're not saying that either. But if we see a kind of escalation here where things get militarized, and you go all the way back to Homer, you know, when you've got it in your hand, there's a temptation to use it. And we've got to be careful about how democracy works. All respect for good policing. And I deeply, solidly mean that and appreciate your call, John. But what about it, Kara? You hear that concern? Here, Devin writes to us on Facebook, says, unnecessary show of force is unacceptable always, but allowing the militarization, Second Amendment crowd, of the citizenry exacerbates the situation. In less armed countries, rarely do people need to respond with heavy armed forces. We have our own arms race within America. Kara, our caller John's kind of saying something similar in that the police are just responding to that.
Well, I hear John's point, and I think that it's an important one. And I think that while we talk about how it's important for our democracy to make sure, as the president said, that we don't blur the lines between the military and the police, we also have to understand that there's a point at which excessively militarizing the police undermines public safety and makes it more difficult for the police to do their job. So we're really talking about effective policing, smart policing, policing that approaches the communities with an attitude of wanting to protect and serve rather than wanting to invade and treat as an enemy. You know, I spoke with a number of members of law enforcement while I was working on this investigation and the report, and many of them said to me things that are very similar to what John was saying, but many of them also said, look, when we come in like an invading force, we make our own jobs harder because we alienate the people in the communities, and we escalate the risk of violence, and we cause problems for our own ability to police communities. So I think it's important to remember that law enforcement is not speaking with a unified voice on this topic. There are many members of law enforcement who feel that militarization makes their job that much harder.
Let me get a call right here from Detroit. Valerie in Detroit, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi. My question is, to what extent are police forces recruiting returning military people who are familiar with all this equipment you're discussing?
Mm-hmm.
I have also heard that gangs on the West Coast are people who were in the military coming back to their gang roles and acting out, and I was wondering about that in terms of the person from Ferguson you had earlier who was talking about people wanting to fight back from the crowd.
Yeah,
so are they returning military people?
Interesting. Radley, how about it? The possibility of, you know, a country that's just at war too long. We get a lot of returning veterans who may end up in police departments and a lot on the street.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's an interesting question. When I started researching my book, I assumed that this was a problem, that people were coming back from the military and were joining police departments, and this was causing some of the militarization. And in fact, during the Clinton administration, there was a program called Troops to Cops that gave police departments grants specifically to hire returning soldiers. But as I started to research the book, I actually talked to several police chiefs, interviewed dozens, but a lot of them who agreed with me on the general militarization problem actually said that the people returning from the military were a good influence on their departments. And what they said is in the military, there's a very a sense of sort of personal responsibility. There are, you know, they do what they call after action reports, where they, you know, they evaluate what went wrong and how they can do things better. And there's a very firm set of protocols that they have to follow when using force that actually, believe it or not, don't exist in a lot of police departments, or that as we've seen in Ferguson, where you have police officers pointing guns at people who they hopefully aren't intending to shoot. So it may actually be that. Some of our domestic police agencies have become so militarized that returning troops joining their ranks actually can serve as a good influence on those departments.
Karadansky, respect for good policing right here, but you've got voices right, left, and center worried about militarization. Do you see the pendulum swinging the other way? Might Ferguson turn it around, or are we so equipped up now, geared up, that it's hard to do?
Well, I think that we can rein in the Pentagon program. We can rein in some of the federal dollars that continue to fuel militarization. And there's a lot of work to be done at the state level following on the example set by Maryland and Utah in terms of requiring more transparency over this. So, you know, I think that there's a lot of work to do, but I think that there's no question that we have to do it.
Karadansky at the ACLU, author of War Comes Home, and Radley Balco at the Washington Post, author of The Rise of the Warrior Cop. Thank you very much to each of you for joining us this hour. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.